KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, Mark Udoff, the new head of the UC system, joins us for an hour of conversation all about the future of the 10-campus system and what his leadership will mean for California and its future, with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Mark Udall officially took over last week as 19th president of the 10-campus University of California system, replacing Robert Dines, who was president for nearly 5 years. The first UC system president in two decades to come from outside of California, President Udall was head of the University of Texas since 2002, and prior to that served as president of the University of Minnesota. His background as an academic is in law, and his specialties are constitutional law, education law, and freedom of expression. University of California includes more than 220,000 students, 170,000 faculty and staff, and an annual budget of some $18 billion with programs in over 150 disciplines. And for the past 12 years, it has generated more patents than any other university in the nation, and despite serious budget restraints and cutbacks, continues to be widely recognized as the nation's premier public institution of higher education. President Udoff joins us for this opening forum hour, and welcome back to radio. I should mention you have part of your bona fides as having been a radio host back in Minnesota days.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here, Michael. Well, I listened to Governor Ventura, and I thought I can do this too. So once a month, I marched off to WCCO and did my thing.
Well, little did you know when you were dealing with a governor who was a wrestler that you'd be dealing eventually with a governor who is a former movie star, plus dealt with Governor Bush, too, in your day, didn't you?
I did. You know, I have one theory. I've dealt with Jesse Ventura, now Governor Schwarzenegger. I was out in his tent. And if Carl Weathers is elected governor of California, I have the trifecta, the three stars of the movie Predator, if you remember that, a very exciting movie. And I did get to know Governor Bush and worked with him for about 2 or 3 years before I left Texas.
As president, in fact, he put you on his literacy committee, didn't he?
I was on the national board of the National Institute for Literacy and worked hard on that. And then currently I'm on his council on service, essentially volunteerism. I get to go to Washington. We meet. I hang out with some movie stars and race car drivers, and we try to advance volunteerism in America.
I eat a lot of pancakes, from what I read.
I do eat a lot of pancakes. It's a lifelong quest for the perfect pancake, and I'm a little worried about California. You know, I don't want any avocado on my pancakes. I don't want pancakes with sprouts. I did find a place in Berkeley that I like, but the quest goes on, and I'm sure that your listeners will have some suggestions.
I even have one. I had a great plate of pancakes up in Eugene, Oregon recently, so I'll have to give you a tip off the air on that one, but there's a segue from predator. We talk about money for a while. There's been predatory practices in some people's minds in terms of the money that's been taken away from the University of California, plus a 7.4% increase for students last year, which amounts to $490. All these budget shortfalls and talk about ways to save money and new revenue streams. I was reading an editorial by Stan Glantz, who has been on the show a number of times and just called in recently. It was in the LA Times. He says the only way to really get finances straight, he's at UCSF, the only way to get finances straight is to sort of abandon three of the campuses and increase fees. And then I read an article about Dick Blum saying, now we can cut back enormously, administrative staff, streamline construction practices and bureaucracy. That's a kind of either or is it?
Well, I think there are substantial savings. Let me start with that. In Oakland, which is really the system office, to me the whole phrase office of the president is sort of a misnomer. These are not people who personally work for me. These are people who run the AIDS research program or the general counsel's office and so forth. But in my opinion, that office, the system office in Oakland, is too big, spends too much money, has too many employees, and I think we'll have substantial savings. The second thing I'd say is, no matter how substantial the savings, when you're talking about a $20 billion operation, which is essentially the University of California, including the labs and everything, the savings alone will not get us over this financial these financial obstacles. And there are only so many funding sources. There are private gifts and endowments, and there's state funding, and then there is student support. And what we've seen over the last 20 years all across America is that the onus is being moved from the taxpayers to the students, that higher ed is being looked upon more as a private good than a public good. I think that's lamentable. Prices are going up everywhere as the burden is being shifted onto the students, and I don't like it a lot, but that's the lot that's been cast.
That's the fate, in other words, I'm hearing you say subtextually about how things have to go in terms of the trajectory.
Well, I don't like it. But that is, I guess it's not what I'm predicting so much for the future, but it has been the history of the last 20 years. You have, this is my view, Michael, we have an aging population that is interested in lockup boxes for Social Security, is interested properly in medical care for the elderly, is interested in police protection and building prisons to lock up the bad guys. Higher education is a budget that in that environment is getting squeezed. And, you know, it's not an accident that when over half of all American families had children under the age of 18 in the 1950s, we had much higher expenditure levels proportionate to our wealth for higher education than we do today. So I think we have a problem, but I'm committed to trying to reverse it. And I think my philosophy is very simple. I want to go over the heads of the California legislature. And there is one group that is over the head of that legislative body, and that's the people of California. And I want to explain to them why the University of California is important to them in terms of their environment, in terms of economic development, in terms of democracy, and in terms of transportation and climate change and all the rest of it. And that's my job. I feel if I can get my message out to the people of California, then perhaps some of these other things will fall into line.
Well, here's an excellent opportunity for you to begin doing just that, because it's a big audience that we have here, and they like to know certainly what the University of California does. And you've also taken the position that, well, transparency and accountability. I keep hearing these words coming up, and they're important as far as your vision and what's ahead for you and what lies ahead, particularly in light of the compensation scandal as it's been characterized. And yet, we're talking about money and we're talking about compensation. There's a realization that maybe the public has to understand that in terms of competing for these top people, you have to pay a lot of money.
I wish it were otherwise. My philosophy is accountability. You know, do we have a good year or a bad year, and how do we prove that? What's the data? Show me the data. In God we trust, all others bring data, is my philosophy. That's a big part of it. Do we have too many employees? Probably so, and if so, that we ought to deal with that. But if we're competing with a physics professor who can work at many universities around the world, if we're not competitive on salary, we're not competitive on the research lab, on support of graduate students, and 100 other things, they'll simply go elsewhere. And the fact is, California is in for the fight of its life. We have been the great public university system for 100 years. It has driven this economy, but there's competition from China, from India, from other states in the United States, and I don't want to be the president of the University of California who watched our competitiveness nationally and internationally erode. That means you need to compete for compensation and at other levels.
Well, the San Francisco Chronicle, as you're probably aware, revealed that millions of dollars in extra compensation and questionable perks, such as extra vacations and bonuses and paid housing, all of these kinds of things. Is all that necessary to lure people here?
Well, is all of it necessary? Of course not. But I think what you ought to ask yourself is, and I don't want to comment on specifics. I wasn't here. I didn't approve it. You know, so
You've got a new slate.
I'm a smiley bureaucrat. This wasn't on my watch, and I'm very big for transparency. But what I would say is that you know, if you're honest about the dollars you're expending, you know, whether that goes for moving expenses or other things, as long as you're forthright, and then I think you've dealt with the disclosure issue, and it is part of being competitive. If everybody else is paying moving expenses, if everyone else pays summer stipends and so forth, you may have to compete at various levels. It's not just the core compensation that's involved. From a personal standpoint, I like simplicity that the taxpayers and everyone else can understand. So to me, it's better if you largely are putting in the direct compensation. But I'm not prepared to say if you guarantee someone a research leave that that's necessarily a bad idea. As long as you disclose it, I think that's okay. If it gets too exotic, I have objections. I don't think we ought to be, you know, paying for a horse stall or some exotic expenditure. People ought to pay their own expenses.
But you're saying whatever it is, the public or the regents will be informed.
Absolutely. I'm just not going to tolerate it. I've told them everything goes on that piece of paper. Everything's revealed to the media, and the public has a right to know. But the public also has to understand that it is really not quite the same thing as being a person who works in a very important job at the state level to try to find people who not only can communicate knowledge but who can discover knowledge. Those are rare talents. So if you want to bring the Nobel laureates and the National Academy of Science type people, the great Institute of Medicine physicians and so forth, if you're not competitive, they're not coming or they're not staying.
Talking to Mark Udoff, who is the new president of the UC campus, says the system of 10 campuses here in California. There's a report that was put out by the Western Association of Schools and Colleges of the Accrediting Association, all about poor governance. They indicted the system for inadequate controls on business procedures and business practices. Now, I know there's a reform effort that's underway, but again, this speaks right to the heart of what some see as troubling in the system. And your vision of things on that score?
Well, I think many of the points were well taken, although I think, as you point out, some measures have been adopted by the board to address them. But, I arrived in the system, and I have heard from people, and I think, frankly, the infrastructure was broken, that the system of controls and accountability and, to some extent, the accounting were not in very good shape. Now, it predates me, but with the leadership of Chairman Blum and others, I think they've gone a long ways to address it, but I think there's still other things to be done. So I think that criticism had a lot of merit to it, and we're trying very hard to fix it. In terms of the board, I mean, the way I view it is simply we had this disclosure scandal, some other things were going wrong. The board stepped in to do some things that absolutely needed to be done, and now we're having, I hope, a return to normalcy. Now, I'm not normal, as people who have met me know, because I'm the first outsider since 1899, so genuine outsider, never having done much in California. So once every century, apparently, Californians give this a ride. But we need a return to normalcy in the sense that you do not manage the University of California from the boardroom. You set policies in the boardroom, and the Board of Regents should set those policies, hire and fire people. That's their prerogative. But you need to operate through the CEO for it to be effective. And I think I have agreement to that, and that's what I'll be looking for, that we all abide by the correct roles. And the management here and public radio and television, you know, they should know their limits. Maybe they do or don't. You could tell me about that. But they really shouldn't tell you how to do your job, and I feel the same way. And by the way, I don't tell the chemistry department at Berkeley who to hire. They know 1,000 times more about it.
You say so, you have the Board of Regents' support on this?
Yes, I believe I do. You worry because sometimes in a crisis, people acquire some habits which are not good habits. But I'm not reticent to engage in dialogue with the board about those issues. And I think if you talk to the leadership of the board, I mean, I asked everyone who interviewed me, every regent, I said, are you prepared to go back to a system where your review is more like appellate review, policy making, hire and firing, but you're not really trying to engineer how the place works? And I got a positive answer, and I expect the board to abide by that.
That includes Mr. Blum.
That includes especially Mr. Blum. He's my friend, Richard and he's Blum. Brilliant. He's got great ideas. And I'm hoping we can march shoulder to shoulder to get a lot of these things done. But, you know, he's the chairman of the board. I'm the chief executive officer. And I think it's important that each of us know our roles. And I think he does know his role.
You were talking before about the concern about fees going up for students. And the highest proportion of low-income students now is right here at UC, I think, certainly the top of research universities as far as low-income students. And there's been an attempt to compensate for students who have come from families under $60,000 a year. What do you see down the road there, I mean, in terms of helping those kind of more poor and, well, lower income particularly?
Well, I think it's very important. I'm very proud of the University of California, Berkeley in particular, but also the other institutions. We have the highest proportion of what are called Pell Grants, that is federal grants for low-income students, of any of the major universities around the country. And that shows that we have some ability to grant access to people who traditionally have not been part of universities and are not from the most affluent classes. And so it's socioeconomic mobility in its best form. Now, the students, the low-income students in some ways are better off in this environment in a weird way, and that is there's often more money through Pell Grants and other mechanisms for families at $40,000, $45,000, $50,000 a year in income. And the people who are quite affluent, and the parents make hundreds of thousands of dollars, they can afford the price tag. So to me, the problem is the middle class. You know, if you make between, say, $50,000 and $100,000 a year, and the gasoline prices are going up and food prices are going up, and you're a little worried about the stability of your job, that's the group of people I worry about the most, because we do have mechanisms for the poor. I'm sure they're imperfect. But that middle class really gets ground up in all this. I still think we're a great buy. I mean, if you're paying $8,000 a year or something like that, compared to you get an education at UC, which is fabulous, and you compare it to the privates and even the other publics. Penn State is more money. University of Michigan is more money. I always say to my students, I wish it were free or close to free. The lower tuition gets, the happier I am. Because I don't ever want a student excluded on the basis of their family wealth. But in this world of expensive daycare and $4 and $5 gasoline, $7,000-$8,000 is a reasonably good buy for a first class education, and people can make up to $1 million more in their lifetime. So there's a with that college degree. So there is a personal impact, too, here.
You have a proposal, though, for helping the middle class that you said you have this great concern about?
Well, I have lots of thoughts. I don't have a proposal today. When I proposed I proposed in Texas that everyone in Texas at the median family income and lower go for free. And but, of course, there's no free ride. The tuition would be higher, but half of all the families would go for free. That gets you beyond just the poorest families. Now, in a state like California, I'm not proposing that here. I need to think about it and analyze the data. There are various things that are done around the world. You know, in Australia, you have a graduated repayment of loans, and loans can be forgiven, and it's based upon your income after you graduate. We in America don't do much of that. I think we'll have to aggressively continue what we're doing. You understand that in a public university, there is the sticker price, the one that the newspapers lament that went up 7%. And then there's the real price. And typically the discounts are 20, 30, 40%. And think of it like a car. You know, in my family, no one could hold their head up if they ever paid the sticker price for an automobile. They would be the black sheep of the family that could not hold their head up. And so, too, what we do is we give selective discounts, and you need to look at the total picture. And I think that's what we're going to end up doing. And we're a little bit like the airlines and other things. We are, to some extent, redistributing wealth in a minor sort of way. We are allowing poorer kids not to pay very much of their tuition, and we're charging full freight for others. And the middle class will need to make adjustments in between.
I'd be a little worried about that airline analogy these days as airlines continue to falter. But
hey, we're still flying. Yeah, we're not Braniff.
You have a commitment to, recruiting in a way which will bring diversity to the University of California, and you've long had this commitment. Any new ideas on that front or a part of your vision for the long
term? Well, I'm thinking about it. I have to explore it. I did ask for a legal analysis of Proposition 209. I'm a lawyer. I'm very law-abiding. I'm going to obey 209, but I wanted to see how the courts had interpreted it, you know, and so that analysis is ongoing. I think with underrepresented students, it's very important to have very aggressive outreach programs, and I understand UCLA has done a lot of that. You need to get counselors and other people into the high schools with large numbers of Latino, African American, and other underrepresented groups, and make your best pitch for your university. Scholarships are important. They can't be race-specific scholarship. They can be for socioeconomically not well-off students. So we're trying to look at all the alternatives. The first thing I want to do is see what we're currently doing. When, as you point out, you have more than 200,000 students and 10 campuses, and I've been on the job 6 days, so I can't honestly tell you. I know all the minority recruitment policies and what financial aid is available. I think those are the two primary means. I think California is one arm tied behind its back because Texas and Michigan and Illinois and other states are, you know, they're coming to California to try to recruit these kids, plus the private schools. And without the ability to have an affirmative action program, without the ability to focus on those minority students, the financial aid, you're a disability.
Talking again with Mark Udoff, you're going to keep a hand in teaching?
I probably will, not this first year. I always say what I do best is oppress law students. I've done it a long time. I'm well practiced. I actually taught contracts, too, and enjoyed that. But I mostly, in recent years, teach constitutional law and a course called Educational Policy in the Law, mostly K through 12 education, everything from school desegregation to school finance and whether the Amish have to send their kids to school and gender discrimination and the like. I'd like to do that, and I have an appointment at Bolt, and Chris Edley, a brilliant man, seems to tolerate me, so maybe he'll let me teach a seminar.
He was Obama's professor at Harvard, in fact, Chris Edley. We've talked about that. Do you foresee teaching having more emphasis, perhaps, in the future than it does? I mean, there's always that kind of equation that perhaps there's too much weight on research as opposed to teaching.
Well, my way of thinking about it, and we are going to have these accountability reports, and I want to know graduation rates and diversity and, how the students are doing and whether they appreciate the education they received. This is difficult to measure, but that I'm looking at that. My feeling is the first obligation of a university is teaching. I have to say that because the people of California have entrusted their sons and daughters. They expect them to get a quality education and, you might say, a fair deal, to quote Harry Truman. And but when you're as high a quality as University of California, you have a right to say you're going to do both. You're going to be effective teachers. You're going to mentor these students, but you're also going to be in the laboratories and you're going to write, anthropology articles and do both, discover knowledge and transmit it effectively.
Let me give the phone number. Join us toll free, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786, or by email forum at kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with the new president of the UC campuses, Mark Udoff, with us this hour, wearing a tie that says University of California, and so, in other words, making his identification complete in the sartorial sense. You have a reputation as sort of a snappy dresser, I think.
Oh, I do?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Besides being a pancake eater.
I photograph very well on radio. It's one of my strong suits, and And yes, I've had to change that. I wore a red tie to my mini bar mitzvah ceremony when I was announced as the new president. I was chastised for wearing the Stanford colors. And then I wore the burnt orange, and I was chastised again for wearing University of Texas. So I have retreated to blue and gold, as I suppose I'm supposed to.
Well, we're going to retreat. Well, not retreat, but move forward with our callers in just a moment. But I wanted to ask you, I'd be remiss if I didn't, about privatization and where you stand on that, since there's been certainly a great deal of press and concern and spotlight on it.
Well, you mean privatization of universities?
You know, research deals between corporations and the universities specifically.
I'm basically in favor, so I want to start there. I think there can be great beneficial collaborations between the private and the public sector. But I think you have to be extremely careful about this. You have to be careful not to give away the intellectual property. You have to be careful not to sell your soul that you're going to be objective. You don't want to partner with the cereal company and tell them how great cereals are for your health and so forth, where people distrust the data. So I think great care is required. But the idea that we could pool the assets in the public sector and the private sector for the public good strikes me as a sound one, and we've done that on many occasions. And
you call it hybridizing or something along those lines.
I called it a hybrid university, yeah. which I meant was, it's not the classic public university where everything is paid for by taxpayer dollars. There are multiple streams of income, and the governance changes a lot because the truth of the matter is, and it's unfortunate, you may not get the external support for the humanities that you get for your, say, your electrical engineering department. So it has a governance dimension and a financial dimension. But I like the idea of the partnership. Remember one thing, in many European countries, they took a different route. But since World War II, the United States has basically invested in the universities to create its research infrastructure. And when you think about it, if you have a pacemaker that was invented at a university, if you like color TV that was invented at a university, if you like ruby red grapefruits that was invented at a university, and so forth down the line. So the nation's very dependent on it, and to some extent so is the private sector, because universities have proven to be so good at the basic research. Oftentimes they look to the universities to do it rather than doing it in their own labs. And so I'm in favor of the relationship so long as it's carefully policed for conflicts and ethical issues, and to make sure that our professors have not in any way sacrificed their academic freedom.
Let me go to your phone calls for President Yudof, and we'll begin with you, Mike. Good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Hi. A recent survey, maybe a year or two ago, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, pointed out that 50% of the sophomores in even your Ivy League expensive schools are semi-literate, have problems with logic, and are in math challenged, or actually even arithmetic challenged. The second question is, I've talked to many professors who say that there is a big problem with stealing of term papers. When I went to school in the 60s and 70s, there was never any thought of plagiarism because we thought it would hurt ourselves. So could you respond to those questions?
Sure. On the first issue, which is, and there have been all sorts of books and articles on this, if you give Americans or students of a certain age a test and ask them to find Kansas, many of them have problems. And can they do basic arithmetic and the like? Can they name their United States senators? So, the sort of literacy of this generation is something that it may be a problem. But I'm not sure it's worse than before. We may just have more information about it. What I'm more concerned about is your second part of that. I think universities have a duty to help develop the cognitive abilities of students. I don't want them just memorizing the Declaration of Independence date in 1776 or when Lincoln was shot. I want them to be able to synthesize ideas, to read and analyze a paragraph. I want them to be able to solve a problem.
Critical thinking?
Critical thinking skills. And I'm worried, I'm not so much worried about the University of California, but I am worried across the country that we have a commodification of knowledge almost in response to this problem that you don't know enough. And obviously you need to know something. If you're going to cogitate, you need to know something to cogitate about. But I am very worried about this, these cognitive abilities, and it's something I probably will focus on down the road to at least think about its curricular implications and talk to colleagues about it. On the term paper thing, I don't know how widespread the plagiarism is, but boy, has it become easy with all these websites and it's so accessible, and universities are struggling with this, and I've noticed that I think it was the University of Chicago Law School does not allow the students to take the computers into the exam room because of what is on the computer and communicating back and forth with each other. We are really struggling with some of these new technologies and the plagiarism problem, which means that there's so much more in the way of materials from which to plagiarize, has accentuated, is one of the problems we need to worry about.
Let me thank Mike for his call and move on to more of your calls for President Udo. Marie Cruz, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'm a worker at UC Berkeley, and my question for President Udo is, what is he going to do to lift service workers out of poverty? Because he was talking about people $45,000 a year, but at Berkeley, the majority of us, low-paid workers in service, we don't make more than $35,000 an hour, a year.
Well, that's a good question. There is a collective bargaining process which is ongoing at the moment, and many of these issues will be addressed. It's not a great financial time for the university, but it's not a great financial time for the workers either. Given their salaries and given the rising cost of most of the things in their lives, it is very difficult. Long term, I have asked people to take a look at these issues of where the minimum should be, not just in terms of what the market requires, but what people need to live on. This is a very difficult issue for us, but I am sensitive to it. I come from a blue collar family. My father was an electrician all his life. So Marie, all I can say is I can't promise you a rose garden, as we say. We have a process, and we're engaged in that. But it is something I want to look at carefully. How do we structure it so that the minimum compensation, which will never be entirely adequate, is more adequate perhaps than it is today to meet the basic needs of families.
I want to comment on your own compensation, since it's been brought up and will be brought up probably in the future. You're the highest paid state employee, and you're making considerably more than President Dines made. More than you made at Texas, of course, too.
Not much more, actually. We don't need to get into that. I think on the whole, I don't want to get into that whole question, but I probably was doing better in Texas for a whole variety of reasons I could explain to you. The Board of Regents sets my salary, so you really need to talk to them. All I would say is people don't move for pay cuts. And if you look across the country, my salary is competitive with what people are paid at the University of Washington and other places. I hope the people get their money's worth. That's really all I can say about it. But you got to get Blum on the air and grill him mercilessly about his salary policies.
Oh, there are other things I'd like to grill him about, too. But why? What brought you here, then? What was it really that was the most tantalizing thing about leaving Texas?
I would say a couple things. The most tantalizing thing is these campuses are great. I mean, from Santa Cruz to San Diego and UCLA and all the progress we're making at Merced and, of course, the great University of California at Berkeley and Davis and so forth. I felt that these were world-class universities and really exciting places. So that was it was an offer that was hard to turn down. I've been doing the job at Texas for 6 years. In terms of the rhythms of my life, I had already told the Regents I could stay no more than two, that I'd done it, been there. They had heard all my jokes. I explored all the pancakes places. I didn't want to turn to waffles. And I just felt I was ready for a change. And so that was really the second reason. The third thing was, having watched the disclosure scandal and watched the need for restructuring, I felt these are things that I had done at the University of Minnesota and the University of Texas. And I don't mean to be have a false sense of pride, but I thought, I do know how to do these things. I've done them before. And if I focus and hire the right people to help me and have the support of the board, that I can get done what the regents hope to get done. And so those are the three primary reasons.
Let me go to more of your calls. Let's go to San Jose. Jennifer, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question for President Udoff. Your discussion about pancakes and waffles are interesting, but I'm a current graduate student at the UC system, and I was hoping that you could maybe elaborate a little bit more on your specific what you're going to do specifically to improve the UC system, particularly in terms of some of the issues that we have in terms of privatizing education and the excessive cost that students are paying to attend the UC. I just, listening to your comments for the past hour, you sound really resigned to the status quo, and I think the UC system prides itself in being innovative, and so I was hoping that you could maybe specify what some of your innovations for the UC system are going to be specifically. Thank you.
Thank you for the call.
Well, you know, I'm not resigned to the status quo. You know, the problem is, I was being realistic. If California were an aberration, then I would say, you know, then maybe we're going to have a quick return to the days of low tuition and high state support. It's a 50-state problem. It's been a problem for 20 years. And it may be that when you're doing your financial modeling and determining where to go with the future of the university, you need to be realistic about that. Now, having said that, you know, my plan is to fight as hard in Sacramento as I can. And as I said, to go over the head in a communications program in Texas, we did a 13-part public television series. We did many things, which we're not currently doing, to show the voters why the university is important and why it's important, even if they don't work on one of the campuses. So there's a delicate balance here, but I would say that I think the caller is saying innovation to her means lower tuition and fees. I'd love for that to happen, but I'm speaking truth to power. Across 50 states over 20 years, it's not happening, and I think we may have to adjust to it. In terms of innovation generally, I would like to see more collaboration and cooperation among the campuses. I think we have a global health initiative at the system level, which is very important. I think we can do a whole lot more to help K-12 education. We cannot succeed at the University of California without a more effective K-12 system that provides us with more African-American and Latino and other students interested and prepared to go to universities. And I don't think we're doing enough, and we need to do a lot more about that. I also think that you may not consider it an innovation, but I think the University of California System Office in some areas has too many powers. There are too many approvals, too many layers of bureaucracy, and the innovation will take place at the campus level. The great universities that I know are really not run from the top or across hundreds of miles. Places like the Sorbonne and like Cambridge and like Oxford and Harvard and University of Chicago and so on. So, you know, sometimes the role of a system office is to get out of the way and facilitate those things. That's something else I want to work on.
Streamlining, isn't that what you're talking about?
I'm talking about streamlining, but I'm also saying if we're not adding value, if we have processes that are costly, involve delays and all the rest of it, if we're not adding value to what's going on in the campuses, in general, we should get out of the way. Now, you know, we have legal responsibilities. They're not allowed to blow up buildings. They're not allowed to engage in sexual harassment. They can't practice racial discrimination. There are all sorts of limitations. But I think the central office is part of the problem, not part of the solution.
Talking to Mark Udoff, new president of the 10-campus University of California system. Let me, before I go to more calls, go to some emails. Here's Mitch, who writes, I'm a current graduate student at UC Berkeley, and I was curious about a comment made by the president. From my general experience in the sciences, but most likely across the board, the new hires made and the general performance of a professor is rated solely on their ability to do research in the laboratory. The teaching ability of most professors is lacking. How can this be turned around to be more along the lines of your intentions to have a more education-centered atmosphere in our system?
Well, I have to apologize because I'm on the job, I guess, as I said, 6 days, so I'm not intimately familiar with the review processes. on each of the campuses.
The higher standard in terms of hiring and retention and tenure still is research, though, and publication.
It may be a higher standard, but I think students at Berkeley and all the campuses are entitled to both, effective teachers and people who can engage in substantial research and gain new knowledge and perspectives. I mean, this is something I'm going to have to just take a look at over time. I mean, I don't know that the observation that the new hires don't teach very well is true.
One student's observation.
Yeah, I'm sort of doubtful. But the exact weighting between teaching and research, I can't comment on. All I think is our students deserve both. And I also think, by the way, the research makes them better teachers. Would you rather be taught by someone who is pushing the borders of knowledge, who really deeply understands the subject, or by someone who's just parroting the lesson plan for that day? I think, on the whole, you're better off with the former.
Of course, you realize that in many instances you're not taught by those professors, you're taught by the TA.
Well, that's another thing our accountability report's going to get into, who is really teaching those subjects. You know, one of the reasons when I teach, I generally do not teach law students, I teach freshmen, because it's important to me that senior professors teach entering students. And it's also a hoot. I learn all sorts of stuff about the world that I, frankly, never knew existed. As we look at this accountability report, you know, over time, one of the things I want to see is that true? How many of those classes are taught by the TAs? How many by the tenured and tenure-track professors? How many by the full-time faculty? And so forth down the line. I mean, I don't think every class needs to be taught by a full professor in introductory Spanish, but I think it's important for the senior professors to teach undergraduates.
Here's another graduate student, says, Dear President Yudof, I'm a humanities grad student at UC Berkeley. Everyone who's taught our required undergraduate reading and composition sequence knows that there's an enormous shortage of sections. We regularly have full enrollment, and full wait lists. And for the first week, the room is always full to overflowing with enrolled, waitlisted, and crashing students. And she wants to know, given the financial situation at the university, when will reading and composition budget be restored to the level necessary for all students to be able to fill their requirement in a timely manner and graduate on time? If they can't get in the class, they can't do that, right?
Well, that's obviously right. I mean, my job is to work as hard to get President Bergeron and the campus more money. And obviously the campus process is determined on how it's determined. But I'm very worried about that. You know, this is the flip side of the question of what are you going to do about fees? I mean, here is the situation. The expenditures per student are going down because the student bodies are growing. And the state allocation nominally goes up, but the amount of money per student is going down. Then we're faced with the tuition and fee issues. If this student thinks it's bad now, we put a freeze on fees and we're getting lower appropriations per student from the state, it will get dramatically worse. A university is a motion picture. It's not a frozen frame. And so that's the dilemma we face. If the fees had gone up more money, probably we'd have more instructors there. But you're balancing what the students can afford and fairness against trying to provide them with the resources they need to get into the courses to do their business. The ideal solution is, instead of the state paying such a relatively small share of our total expenses, if we could go back to the halcyon days when they paid 50 and 60% of the overall instructional cost, it would be much easier to provide you with the teachers that you need. And this is a big worry of mine because people think that rising tuition and fees are the only punishment. There's also another punishment. When you run out of money and you don't have enough sections and the students can't graduate in 4 years and they have to stay an extra semester or a year, that's punishment, unfortunately, for our students, too. So we're sometimes picking between evils, and it's a real nettlesome issue.
You've also had a big pipeline from the community colleges, and the community colleges have suffered enormously in terms of cutbacks. And these are often the students who can least afford, not only in the middle class that you spoke of earlier, but particularly in the lower income brackets as well. I just wanted to get that in there because we've done programs certainly addressing that. And we'll get more callers in here. Steve, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Thanks. Thanks for the program, Michael. One quick comment on teaching quality, and then to the question I wanted to ask on salaries. We can't forget that part of teaching, especially at the top research institutions, is training a new generation of researchers at the graduate level, and those often are not taken into account when we look at class evaluations. Going to the issue of salaries, I was amused by your question, Michael, to Professor Udoff on his compensation. Faculty member at Berkeley, I realize that we're at somewhat of a disadvantage. When we compete so-called big boys over top scholars, we're paying market salaries to either bring in people or keep our best people. But one aspect that we have to face and is challenging is that we have this public scrutiny on these market salaries that don't exist for the private institutions. I wonder, Professor Udoff, if you have any ideas on how to change the culture of how we're scrutinized.
Well, I have a strong views on this, and we may disagree. I want competitive salaries at every level, certainly for professors. That is enormously important, but also for chancellors and vice chancellors and staff members and people who belong to ASME and all the rest. But I'm sorry that sometimes people misuse the data or are unduly critical in the eyes of some. I really see no choice. I mean, it's a little bit like the First Amendment. It's a little bit like open meetings laws and open records laws. This is very important to how our government works and how our universities work. It's very important to be honest about it. And maybe every private university doesn't reveal what it pays every professor, and there's nothing to be done about it. But we're a public university, and I think we just have to absorb the criticisms, respond to the criticisms, explain to people why that professor is worth the money and what he or she contributes to the university. And I'm in favor of a more responsible criticism and accountability. But like the First Amendment, I think you tolerate some goofball newspaper articles. But the idea of the First Amendment and the idea of a free press able to criticize the government is a vital idea to our democracy. And I'm totally committed to this open disclosure policy.
Your book on the First Amendment still out and available, by the way?
Well, I think I bought all the remainder copies. My mother was tired of buying copies. It's called When Government Speaks. And as luck would have it, it was published by the University of California Press. And It deals with the issue of primarily of government's own involvement in speech, whether it's teaching in the public schools or Smokey the Bear or public radio.
Speaking of Smokey the Bear, have you become a Bears fan?
I'm working my way toward it. I have not actually attended a game yet. But yes, I have all the right ties. I have the paraphernalia. Chancellor Bergeron has invited me to the game.
The right ties in both senses. I'm looking again at your University of California tie.
I'm ready for it, and I look forward to it.
John from San Mateo says, what are Mr. Udoff's views on compensation for coaches? Are they really worth more to the UC system than professors and possibly even Mr. Udoff himself?
Well, John, what I can say is I'm a big believer in markets. I mean, I think we need to be competitive when you pay the president and the chancellor and the professors and so forth. And I don't know what to say. You know, when I do my job, not a lot of people will pay to watch me do it. You know, and regents meetings are interesting, but we never have tens of thousands of people there, at least to my knowledge. I just think we're whistling in the dark here. I mean, I think in God's eyes, I would pay an elementary school teacher more than the president of the University of California or more than an engineering professor and certainly more than a basketball or football coach. But we're dealing with markets, and I really don't think we can swim upstream from this. And I hope that in every endeavor, whether it's football or baseball or women's soccer or whatever, we're competitive, and we're competitive in the English department, and we're competitive in the chemistry department. That's my goal, but it's just not – we cannot just will equality in these salaries. There are markets and competition for the talented people.
You brought up the Australian system before, and in fact, one of the listeners, Mark from Berkeley, writes, Mark Udoff mentioned – Mr. Udoff, President Udoff, Professor Udoff, take your pick. Mark Udoff mentioned the Australian system. I got a great college education in Australia in the days when it was entirely free, and I felt that I wasted my time there because I didn't value it as much as I would have or should have. Students pay a fixed percentage of their post-graduating income until the cost is repaid, though it is not the entire cost of the education. Australia is a more peaceful, democratic, and unified society in large measure because of this and other redistribution mechanisms. Mark Udoff mentioned the importance of this and other options, such as the Australian system, but seemed easily resigned to the way things are. Seems in many ways, in many areas, Americans need new ideas, new vision, new thinking. Why not the Australian system for the UC system? What stands in the way of adopting such a system?
Well, I'm certainly willing to think about it. I mean, that's why I mentioned it, precisely because it was not the conventional way of thinking about it. I raised it. To my knowledge, it hasn't been raised in the legislature. It hasn't been raised in other circles in California. So I think we ought to explore it. But again, it's just not an act of will. If I think it's a good idea, you know, that's that and a couple of bucks will get you a cup of coffee almost everywhere. I think it's certainly worth exploring because it's a way of getting around this this financial barrier that many students are encountering. So we will explore it and we will explore other things.
Can we get you on here real quick, Ray, because we're almost out of time?
So welcome to California. Wonder if you would be providing, for the purposes of critical feedback for your for the university community, will you be providing contact information like an email or other address?
Yeah, how can people reach you to get give you visionary ideas or whatever they want to contribute to?
Well, I hope I have the address right. I think it's president at ucop.edu. That's University of California Office of the President .edu. President at ucop.edu. So I'm always open to ideas and I promise I'll look at them carefully and we'll try to assess them.
Let me echo Ray's sentiments and welcome you again to this august position you're holding and hope that things work out the best for you.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate your inviting me on, and hope we can do it again. I have many things I want to tell your audience about higher education and why they should care passionately about it.
We will do it again. Thank you, Mark Udoff, again, new president of the UC campuses and the UC system. We have another hour coming up. Actually, we're all over the board today with UC because George Lakoff is joining us in the hour ahead. He's professor, holds a chair, in fact, of cognitive science and linguistics at the University of California and has written a new book called The Political Mind. I hope you will join us for that. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell and Kevin Guillory. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez, and I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.